Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Kate, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Update on Thyroid Cancer. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, including the Thyroid Cancer Survivors Association, Inc., THYCHI, which has been very involved in helping to spread the word about this program. And actually, because of this collaboration, we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 545 participants, so really a really great credit to all of you. And you come from all of the United States, and we also have international participants from Canada, Germany, India, Ireland, Mexico, Peru, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world, and so this is a bit of a global call. And today's program was made possible by Bayer Healthcare and Genentech, a member of the Roche Group. And I really want to thank them for their support of the program and also for their partnership, their corporate partnership in making this happen. And I want to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about our speakers and for the topics they'll be addressing, and all of those collaborating organizations that we will have as a resource for all of you. And there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment at the end of the program today and complete that evaluation form. And when you think about it, who but each of you are the very best people to tell us the programs we should be offering? And this is the beginning of a new year, and we're planning many programs. And I would say that this topic of thyroid cancer is one that many of you have requested us to offer, and so here it is. But you may have other interests as well, and please tell us the topics that you would find helpful. We want to be sure these programs are relevant to your needs. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Michael Tuttle, and Dr. Tuttle is member and attending physician, endocrinology service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor of medicine, Joan and Sanford I. Weill Medical College of Cornell University. And Dr. Tuttle is going to address an overview of thyroid cancer, diagnosis and staging, treatment options, novel approaches to treat refractory thyroid cancer, and the importance of communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Tuttle.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. This is really very exciting. 500 and some participants from all over the world. That really is wonderful. It truly is amazing to me because my daughter, who's 30 years old, says 20 years ago nobody knew what her dad did because thyroid cancer used to be this rare tumor that nobody ever heard about. And now, not only in the United States, but in most countries in the world, the incidence of thyroid cancer is increasing dramatically, such that now it's one of the most rapidly rising thyroid cancers in terms of new diagnosis. And I can hardly go anywhere these days without somebody asking me about a family member or a friend or somebody that's had thyroid cancer. Obviously, people always want to know, why is the rate going up? What is it that's causing this huge increase? Is something causing the thyroid cancer? And in large part, we think largely what's causing the rise is just a lot of diagnosis of small cancers. When I was a fellow 20 years ago, we couldn't diagnose thyroid cancers that were less than about an inch because we couldn't feel them. And now with ultrasounds and biopsies, we can biopsy and diagnose little teeny tiny thyroid cancers. So what we're seeing is a big rise in a lot of very small thyroid cancers. But that's not the whole story, because we're also seeing a rise in bigger thyroid cancers as well. So as a community, we're still trying to figure out if there is a cause to this, what's the cause, and, you know, the big question is how could we prevent it and how do we sort it out? When we look at how most people get diagnosed with thyroid cancer, in the old days, it used to be because the doctor would feel the neck. A lot of times these were GYN doctors that were really good at feeling necks. Other times it was the patients themselves, guys shaving or ladies putting on their makeup. But what we're seeing nowadays is more and more of these are incidentally found. You get an ultrasound for the carotid and you accidentally see the thyroid, or you can't go to an emergency room in the United States without getting a CT scan or an MRI of the neck that finds these little small thyroid nodules. So these days we're accidentally finding a lot of little small thyroid nodules. The other thing that's happening is primary care doctors and well-meaning doctors are ordering a lot of ultrasounds of the thyroid, probably for not really great reasons. The thyroid blood tests look a little bit funny, or maybe the thyroid feels a little bit funny, and so we're doing ultrasounds on lots of people. That's good and that's bad, because it turns out if you're an adult in the United States and you let me do an ultrasound of your neck, there's at least a 50% chance I'm going to find a little nodule in your thyroid. The vast majority of those are benign, but a few will be thyroid cancer. And so we end up having to do what we call fine needle aspiration. This is a little teeny tiny needle that usually we put into the skin of the neck, right into the thyroid in the front of the neck. Use the ultrasound to guide right where we're going in there, and take out a few cells. It's a really small needle, smaller than what we draw a blood test, and most of us don't even numb up the neck. You need just a few cells out of that nodule to be able to tell whether it's benign, which means it's not cancer, or whether it's a cancer. The biopsies are pretty good. Sometimes we get back these, we call them indeterminate biopsies or suspicious biopsies, and it's frustrating both to the patient and to us, because that means we can't 100% tell. It might be cancer, it might not be cancer, and we're often put in the situation where we have to do a surgery to figure out whether it's cancer or not. And often say, you know, you end up taking out a thyroid and it's not cancer. So that can be frustrating. There's a lot of fancy molecular tests that are being worked on to help us with that situation, but we're still faced with it a lot. But needless to say, most people that are diagnosed with thyroid cancer have a relatively small thyroid cancer, usually confined to their thyroid. It's asymptomatic, which means they usually don't feel it. Interestingly, the thyroid blood tests are almost always normal. And everybody asks about that. How can I have thyroid cancer if my blood tests are normal? But in thyroid cancer, they're essentially always normal. The only staging we do most of the time before the surgery is just that neck ultrasound. The same ultrasound that we use to look at the thyroid and the thyroid nodules, we also use to look at the lymph nodes in the neck. Because primarily thyroid cancer stays in the thyroid, or it goes to the lymph nodes beside the thyroid. And when we talk about treating thyroid cancer, we're largely talking about surgery, and we want to be able to take out the thyroid as well as any involved lymph nodes. If there's a lot of lymph nodes, we may do CT scans of the neck or chest, but for the vast majority of people, the only staging they're going to have before their surgery is really just a neck ultrasound. Because with the biopsy of the nodule and with the ultrasound, that tells us where to start. The treatment options for thyroid cancer actually are incredibly effective. And these actually haven't changed very much in about 50 years. The primary treatment is thyroid surgery, where the surgeon takes out either half or all of the thyroid, depending on how big or small the thyroid is. That's major surgery because you get put to sleep and anesthesia and all that. But most people are up walking around the next day. They're back at work usually about a week later and on thyroid hormone pills. In experienced hands, it's a very safe surgery, and the recovery is usually fairly straightforward. After the surgery, you come back and we'll look at the pathology report and try to decide whether or not any additional treatment needs to be done. And that additional treatment most often involves something called radioactive iodine. Radioactive iodine, I used to be in the Army, and so I call this my heat-seeking missile. You swallow it, it goes everywhere through your body, and about the only place it stops is where there's any little small focus of thyroid cancer. And so if we look at the pathology report and the surgical findings, and we think that there may be some leftover thyroid cancer that's microscopic, then we can use radioactive iodine to kind of clean up the dust in the corners. It's the unusual case where we would even consider chemotherapy or external beam radiation. Those are really just the small percentage of people that have really sort of locally aggressive disease in the neck. So by and large, the treatment is surgery and then a little bit of radioactive iodine. One of the things that's come up over the last several years is now that we're diagnosing these really small thyroid cancers, the question about whether or not they even need to have surgery. The Japanese have over 1,000 patients that they followed for 10 years that they know have little small thyroid cancers but haven't even done surgery, and they're all doing great. And so we have a program here, as other centers do, where we're beginning to give people the option about if you have a very, very small thyroid cancer confined to the thyroid, to think about watching rather than rushing to a surgery. That's still new. Not everybody's agreeing to that, but you're going to hear a lot about that, which is when we're diagnosing little small stuff, do we really need to intervene and be really aggressive? In terms of recurrences, thyroid cancer does have a fairly significant recurrence rate because it tends to involve the lymph nodes. But the recurrences, while they're disturbing and scary, generally are very, very treatable, either with another surgery because it's usually lymph nodes in the neck, or with some more radioactive iodine. So most people's experience with thyroid cancer, even though it's scary and it's often the first disease some 30-year-old or 40-year-old has ever had, the good news is the outcomes are really excellent and the treatments are very, very effective. Now, we will occasionally see patients that those initial treatments don't work as well as what we want to. And in the language, people will often call those radioactive iodine refractory, which means that radioactive iodine doesn't work either at all or doesn't work as well as what we'd want to. And in those situations, we do have to think about other treatments that may be some additional surgery, maybe some external beam radiation, or maybe some systemic therapies. I hesitate to use the word chemotherapy because chemotherapy to us all means terrible medicines and everybody gets really sick. But the last several years in thyroid cancer has seen a dramatic rise in some pills that we can use with relatively small side effects that actually are quite effective in those few patients that need it. And this year, for the first time, we actually had one of those medicines FDA approved called sorafenib. So now when we have patients that have the radioactive iodine refractory progressive disease that we need to treat, they don't all have to go on to a clinical trial, but rather we actually have at least one FDA-approved drug that we can use now. Clearly, as the field moves forward, there's a lot of emphasis on clinical trials and how we move this forward, and Chris is going to talk about more of that when I hand this over to him in just a second. So if you think about the overview of thyroid cancer, it's increasingly common. More and more people are being diagnosed. That we're diagnosing small volume thyroid cancer in a lot of times. So the old paradigm of everybody getting a big surgery and everybody giving radioactive iodine is sort of now no longer that one size fits all. We're trying to be more selective, and if you've got a small thyroid cancer that's likely cured with a small surgery, that's all that we'll do. If it's a bigger cancer and it's not cured, then we'll do a little bit more. So the challenge to patients and the challenge to clinicians when we're all comparing our cases is the treatment that one patient gets probably doesn't look anything like the treatment the next patient gets as we as clinicians and part of the healthcare team work together to individualize your care. And I think that's the real key to this issue of communicating with the healthcare team. We do view thyroid cancer as a team approach here. My nurses, my surgeons, my medical oncologist, my colleagues all feel like we're part of the team, and at the center of that team is the patient. And our job is to give you as much information as you can, help you understand the issues as best we can, and then give you our best advice, and then work back and forth with that to try to find out what's the optimal care for you. As we say, trying to get the right treatment to the right patient at the right time, every time. Thanks, Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Tuttle. That was really wonderful and just a wonderful comprehensive overview of thyroid cancer, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Christoph Miskowitz, and Dr. Miskowitz is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Hematology, and Medical Oncology, Assistant Professor of Otolaryngology, Tisch Cancer Institute, ICANN School of Medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital. Dr. Miskowitz is going to address the role of clinical trials, how research contributes to your treatment options, managing treatment side effects, and nutritional concerns and tips. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Miskowitz.
Thank you very much. So it's really nice to have, 500 people listening. I feel like I'm in New York right now, like being in Madison Square Garden. So it's an excellent feeling. So I'm going to try to talk about the role of clinical trial, the benefits, the risk, potential future of those clinical trials that we currently see in thyroid cancer management of the side effects and nutritional tips. So obviously the first question is, what is a clinical trial? So a clinical trial is a research study that tests how well the new treatment, and this treatment can be a surgery, new surgical approach, new form of radiation, maybe new pill, maybe intravenous drug, and how this new treatment works in a group of people, and in this case, patients with thyroid cancer. And people who take part in the clinical trial, obviously, they contribute to the overall knowledge that we can learn more about this disease and how we can treat it better. And obviously, during this experiment, during the study, some additional information is being collected from patients, such as risk, side effects, how effective it is. So overall, the role of clinical trial is to improve our knowledge about the disease, and obviously, those results, obviously, we can use in our daily practice, how we treat our patients with thyroid cancer. So what are really the benefits if patients, they can, you know, participate in the clinical trial? So first, obviously, as participants, they have access to very promising new approaches that are not available outside of the clinical trial settings. So, for example, in thyroid cancer up to 2012, for medullary as well well-differentiated thyroid cancer, there was no single drug that was approved by the FDA, one exception, the chemotherapy, such as doxorubicin, that nobody was using because it was too toxic. So the first drug that was approved for medullary thyroid cancer, it was in 2012, and it was vandetnib. And 2013, we have cabozantinib, and then recently we had sorafenib. So previously, up to 2012, basically we had no treatment that would potentially can be offered to those patients. So the only way to be treated, obviously, it was by participation in the clinical trial. So I think this is the major benefit. And at the same time, the drugs that are being studied, obviously, they may be more efficacious. They can be more potent than the current standard approach. So obviously, right now, we have those drugs that I mentioned, but probably the new generations of the approaches may be able to offer better results. And at the same time, we have to understand that it's not just about efficacy. And those new trials and the new form of treatment, they may be not more potent, maybe they're not going to be more efficacious, but at the same time, maybe they're going to offer substantially less side effects. And I think this is one of the major concerns that the patients they have as we treat them. At the same time, obviously, if you're going to participate in the clinical trial, it gives you the access to very well-trained research team. It's going to be nurses, surgeons, radiation oncologists, etc. All of them, they have experience in dealing with new experimental approaches. At the same time, participants can be the first one getting the benefit from the study. And obviously, there is an altruistic approach as well, because if you participate in the study, it's going to help other patients. Maybe some of you already participated in the clinical trials with the medications that were mentioned, such as sorafenib, vandetnib, or cabozantinib. And thanks to you, currently, those medications, they are commercially available and then can be offered to our patients. So obviously, on behalf of us investigators, I want to thank you. But at the same time, obviously, we have to talk about the risks and maybe disadvantages of participating in the clinical trials, and we have to mention them as well. So obviously, those new strategies are not always better than standard, and obviously, most of the time, we're trying to be very careful as we select those new approaches, and obviously only the ones that are promising, we're going to put them into the clinical trials and we're going to test them, but at the same time, yes, there is a risk. Obviously, some of those new treatments can have unexpected side effects, they can have some risk, and maybe they're going to be a little bit more toxic than the current standard of care, so this is the other risk. Sometimes participants may be required to have more visits than if they're going to be treated with the standard approach, because obviously if those new treatment modalities are being tested, we have to be very careful. So obviously those patients, they have to be very closely followed up. And sometimes those studies, they have the process, what we call it, a randomization. So patients are being randomized to the active drug, or they can get the placebo, or we can call it the sugar pill. And obviously, the doctor and the patient, they don't know what medication patient is receiving. And for some patients, obviously, can be difficult to kind of accept the fact they're not going to be receiving active drug. So this is the other risk. So what is the process? So how we move from kind of our mind when we discover a new drug and we just move it to the clinical practice. So first, before any drug or any form of therapy is being tested on humans, it has to be tested on animals, and we call it a preclinical data. And obviously, subsequently, once this preclinical data looks promising, FDA have a checkpoint. So basically, what happens, scientists or researchers or industry, they have to get a special application called IND, in which you have to describe the results of the preclinical testing. You clearly have to define how futures will be conducted, and then subsequently, you can design the clinical trial, and this form of therapy is going to be tested on humans. And there are three phases of clinical trials. The goals of phase one clinical trials is to select the dose that's going to be used in the future. So basically what we do, we give this new form of the treatment to the patient at a certain level. So you take, let's say, X amount of tablets, and then we're trying to find out what is the maximum tolerated dose that the patient can receive with this new therapy. And this is the purpose of the phase one clinical trial. And then after we know the dose, we can move to phase two. And the purpose of the phase two is to get the information about relative safety and efficacy, so how toxic and how effective this drug is. And sometimes those phase two clinical trials can have the process of randomization. So yes, there is a possibility that about 50% of the patients, they may be receiving active drug, but 50% of the patients, they may be receiving placebo, which is the sugar pill. But not all phase two clinical trials are having the randomization. And subsequently, once we know the dose, once we know the side effect profile, as we know the efficacy, then we have to prove that this new form of therapy is better than the current standard, and it's called phase three. So those are the studies that are much larger, and obviously, the goal of this trial is to show that this new form of treatment is better. And after the phase three study is completed, a company or scientist can request FDA for marketing approval, meaning that make this drug, make this new form of the treatment eligible and something that can be prescribed by clinician. But at the same time, even you can think that this process is over, and it's not. So even after approvals, review continues. Just to ensure that we know about the other side effects that can come later on. For example, all cases, they have to report all adverse events. There is a quality control, and this information has to be provided to the sponsors. At least we know how safely administer those drugs. So where we stand in clinical trials and thyroid cancer? So obviously, most, as Dr. Tuttle mentioned, most of patients are being treated surgically and they treated successfully. But some of them, some patients, they have advanced cancers that can be hard to treat just with surgery. And some of them, they can be treated with radioactive iodine, and those are mainly the patients with well-differentiated thyroid cancer. The radioactive iodine cannot be given to patients with medullary thyroid cancer. And researchers are looking for new ways to treat the thyroid cancer that they're going to be more effective and can lead to fewer side effects. So I think we're moving to this new era when we're trying to be more personalized, or we're trying to be more targeted, because as we know, the chemotherapy, those are very, very toxic medications. They're not very selective. They kind of not only destroy the cancer, but destroy even the healthy tissue. So we're trying to be more targeted, as we call, and that's why we're kind of trying to offer what we call a targeted therapy. And traditionally, the treatment decisions were usually based on the big studies, and basically, we're trying to design the best approach for the average population. But at the same time, we know that we have some similarities, but obviously we are different. So obviously we're trying to have more individual approach. And obviously personalized approach is a novel form of treating the cancer, and it's usually based on the personal cancer genome, which is kind of a genetic code that is embedded in cancer. So as giving you a few examples. So for example, presence of some mutations, and those are like damages of the GNN code called, for example, BRAF or RET. Those are the mutations that can be seen in thyroid cancer, and sometimes they are associated with a little bit more aggressive form of the disease, can be linked to the drug that actually target those mutations. So when you have the BRAF mutation, you can be on the clinical trial that's going to target the BRAF mutation. We call them BRAF inhibitors. So this is kind of the form of personalizing the treatment, and this is, I think, the direction that we're going to be going into. And at the same time, I'm very excited to mention that at Mount Sinai, we offer the personalized approach that involves identification of all mutations that the cancer has, your cancer, the patient's cancer, and based on the selection of those mutations, we can identify what we call the driver mutations, the ones that are driving the cancer, and we can identify the mutations that are not really driving the cancer, and we call them passengers. And those mutations can be embedded into a fruit fly. So kind of the fruit fly carries your cancer. It's exactly the same replica of your cancer. And obviously the flies are inexpensive. They very easily to test. And what we do, we feed them with a different medication. So we have a library of FDA-approved drug, and those flies carry your cancer are being fed with different combinations of FDA-approved drug. And it's kind of like a selection process. So this way we can identify, in your case, what is the best way to treat your cancer. And what we use that, we use some what we call it a surrogate. So if the fly dies at the early stage, we say that this combination was too toxic. If we see the fly that carries your cancer, that it is getting better and the cancer is disappearing, we can say that the combination is working. And this method was actually used with the Vandetnib. This is the FDA-approved drug that is being used in medullary thyroid cancer. When the company, they came and they gave us different compounds, asking which one's going to be the best one to use. And through this process, Vandetnib was identified and subsequently was tested in clinical trials, and now is approved and being used in medullary thyroid cancer. So I think this is the direction that we're going into. Now I'm going to mention about the side effects. Obviously, there are different forms of therapy of thyroid cancer. One of them, it is surgery, radiation, radioactive iodine, and what we call targeted therapy, or pills that we can give to treat thyroid cancer. So in terms of the radiation, there are acute side effects, something that you can experience as you're receiving the radiation and immediately after. And those side effects are usually inflammation of your mouth. We call it the mucositis. You can have some taste problems. At the same time, you can be producing more saliva and more mucus. And those are the what we call acute side effects. But they're going to happen as you're being the treatment, but they're going to disappear. So maybe they're not as important. I think the more important side effects are the ones that are going to stay with you for the rest of your life, or say you may have them. And those side effects that you may experience are dryness of the mouth. We call it xerostomia. Or you can have some fibrosis, which is like a stiffness of the neck. Unfortunately, we don't have any good treatment for fibrosis, and usually we refer those patients for physical therapy. But in terms of the dryness of the mouth, different forms of the treatment can be used, and I encourage you to participate in the clinical trials. And different medications, different approaches, even acupuncture was tested. So obviously, yes, I just want to encourage you to participate in those. But at the same time, obviously, there are other side effects that you can experience, and those are mainly coming from the pills or intravenous medications that sometimes are given for thyroid cancer. And obviously, those can be nausea and vomiting, currently, because we have very good anti-nausea medicines, we call it antiemetics, it's not usually a problem. With new generation of treatment that are offered for thyroid cancer, we don't see this as much as we used to. The side effects that we do see can be upset stomach, diarrhea, fatigue, and sometimes the way to address them is just to discuss with your physician, because maybe you're going to need a medication to help you with the side effects, but sometimes you may need a dose reduction, meaning that we have to go down on your dose. And currently, the research and the effort is that we're trying to make the cancer treatment more effective and lessen its side effects. So we're trying to discover the drugs that provide better toxicity profile, better anti-nausea medicines. In some cases, we offer psychological support programs and group support, obviously, to help you to deal with those side effects. And those are the main ones. And lastly, I just want to mention diet. And I think this is the very important part of the treatment. And I think there is some controversial topics and the management of the thyroid kinship that are addressed by the diet. So, for example, we know that as we receive radioactive iodine, you are being recommended to eat less iodine. So we provide you with the information what to eat in order to consume less iodine. And it's usually 7 to 2 days before you're going to receive treatment with radioactive iodine, and usually continue for 2 days after. And this information, what exactly you can or you cannot eat, I refer you to THYCA, which is a website for the thyroid survivors. And there is a long list of food products that you can or you cannot eat as you about to receive radioactive iodine therapy. Also, we know that one of the side effects of treatment with radioactive iodine is inflammation of your salivary glands. And there are some doctors, they offer lemon candies because there is some controversy that maybe it can help you alleviate those side effects. And the last one, obviously, as we offer you any form of oral therapy, so yes, the dietary habits, they can have important impact if this medication that you take, if it's going to be really absorbed by your body. So, for example, when you take sorafenib, we know that if it's going to be combined with the high fatty meal, the bioavailability, so how much it's going to be absorbed, is going to be decreased. So we do recommend that it has to be taken on the empty stomach. So it has to be, you can eat 1 hour before, and you shouldn't be eating 2 hours after. So it's going to increase the potency and efficacy of this drug. So I just want to conclude on this, and I'm going to be more than happy to answer any questions that can come up during this discussion.
Well, I want to thank you so much. That was a really outstanding presentation, and really you covered a lot of different issues, and I think the issue of the diet was really important in terms of the medication as well. People don't often realize that, so that's such an important issue. I'm sure there'll be more questions during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Sarah Kelly, and Ms. Kelly is an oncology social worker at Cancer Care. She's coordinator of our older adult services at Cancer Care, and she's going to address the free psychosocial services offered by Cancer Care and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Carolyn. I also wanted to thank Dr. Tuttle and Dr. Miskowitz. I mean, that's such a comprehensive overview that you gave and really a lot of great information. So as Carolyn said, I'm an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, and I work with many people coping with thyroid cancer and also their loved ones. You know, we've been talking today about the diagnosis of thyroid cancer and different treatments, really about managing your care. And I'd like to talk about the importance of creating a support network as part of that care and how Cancer Care can be a part of that. So to begin, just a little bit about us. You know, you're on this call today, so I'm sure you do know about Cancer Care, but I'm just going to very briefly go over the different services we provide. So we're a national nonprofit organization. We provide free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Our programs include individual counseling, which we provide face-to-face in the New York area, and then over the telephone nationally. We have support groups, which we also provide face-to-face in New York and over the phone nationally, and also online nationally and internationally. We have education programs like the one we're on today. We can provide practical help. We can help you navigate the healthcare system. We also provide some limited financial assistance as well as chemotherapy copay assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers, and they are completely free of charge. And oncology social workers really are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her support network, his or her family and friends. We're also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease. So the financial demands, physical changes, social adjustments, psychological impact, and overall care. And I think that adjusting to and finding ways of coping with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process along with treatment. So as you know, cancer affects the whole person and also the support network. That is why finding other supports is just so important. You know, I think asking for help by joining a support group, contacting a social worker is really a sign of strength. And I cannot stress enough that you don't have to walk this path alone. That's really what I'd like for you to take home from what I'm speaking about today. You know, if you join a support group, you're connecting with others who are going through a similar situation. With individual counseling, you really have a space that's yours to voice the concerns that are coming up for you. And I feel the connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and also the treatment. So at this time, I'm just going to very briefly go over what's available. So we have both patient groups and caregiver groups, so groups for your loved ones, available face-to-face if you're in the New York area. We also have both of those groups available on the phone and also online. If you are interested in any of the groups or any of our services, you can call our helpline. And that's 1-800-813-HOPE or 1-800-813-4673. And then I also recommend, if you can, visiting our website, and that's www.cancercare.org. And I believe you guys have this information in your packets, but I just want to give you the information. So our website is very comprehensive. There's a lot of information on there, not only about support, but also all of our programs, the thyroid cancer diagnosis and treatment, and also just ways of helping you cope as you go through this. You know, we've learned a lot from today's program, and there's a lot of information to digest and get your arms around. Our social workers are here to help you do that and help you understand what it means for you and your family. So, you know, really, again, you're not alone in this. You do not have to walk the path alone. Cancer Care Services are here to help you. If you need us, call us. Thanks, Carolyn.
Oh, thanks, Sarah. That was wonderful. Thank you so much. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions, and I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If for some reason we don't get to your question, or you think of a question in a day or next week or in a couple of weeks, call Cancer Care, 1-800-813-HOPE. And I'll repeat that number again. But for the time being, let's see how many of your questions we can take right now. And we'll have all of our speakers on board now. Kate, could you explain to everybody how to queue up for questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from the line of Emil F. Your line is open.
Hi. I am on Synthroid for the last 20 years because of a non-working thyroid. What are my chances of ever getting thyroid cancer?
Well, thank you for asking that question, Emil. That's an excellent question. Dr. Tuttle, could you address that question?
Yeah, this question comes up a lot. So fortunately, the underactive thyroid conditions, which is what we're probably talking about, which is just hypothyroid, is very seldom associated with thyroid cancer. So they run independently. Because we think once the thyroid dies and slows down, it's very unlikely to convert into thyroid cancer. It's always a little tricky because anybody that's got an underactive thyroid, they're being followed more carefully by their doctor, and we do more ultrasound, so we'll occasionally find a thyroid cancer in there, but we don't consider an underactive thyroid as a risk factor for developing thyroid cancer.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from the line of Allison F. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. There's a group of us listening, and our question is really a two-part question. We would like to know the percentage of thyroid cancers that are medullary and what treatment options are there for that diagnosis.
Okay, thank you, Ellie. And Dr. Viscos, could you address that question, please?
Sure. So medullary cancer, it's not as common as well-differentiated thyroid cancer. It's less than 5%. The mainstay of the treatment is always surgery. And there are a few patients that they can develop recurrent or metastatic disease. And currently we have two treatment options for those patients. So one is fondetinib, the other one is cabozantinib. Those are the first-line therapy, meaning that if you have a metastatic disease, that after the surgery you still have evidence, then you can be on those medications. Both of them are orals. Obviously, they're not intravenous. They're not considered chemotherapy. They're considered targeted therapy, meaning that they're going to be targeting the cancer rather than the healthy tissue. But at the same time, they do have some side effects. Those are usually upset stomach, diarrhea, fatigue, and in some rare cases, you can have the thickening of the palms and the soles.
Excellent. Thank you. And I hope that helps, Allie. Thank you. And our next question comes from one of our online participants, Julie. It's a two-part question, and I'm going to ask Dr. Tuttle to address this one. Can they make a mistake on the biopsy? That's question number one. And then the second one is, and when it is suspicious, when it says suspicious, is that bad to wait? I'm extremely scared to go ahead with surgery because of all the bad effects of the meds and issues with surgery. Dr. Tuttle,
yeah.
Could you address that?
Really important question. So when we do the biopsies are right about 95% of the time. So that's pretty good. So if we biopsy it and say it's benign, it's not a cancer, we're going to be right 95% of the time. We don't tell you to go away and never come back. We say come back and we do another ultrasound in a year. And the few times that we're wrong, it slowly grows and we find out about it. We're wrong, as it were, in the suspicious biopsies a little bit more, because depending on which hospital that you're being seen at and how the pathologists read it, a suspicious biopsy might be cancer anywhere between 25 and 75% of the time. So depending on who's reading the slide. So the suspicious biopsies are often difficult because the only way most of the time to know 100% for sure is to actually take the thyroid out and get it onto a slide and be able to see it. This is the realm that some of these fancier molecular testings are being used, where if you have one of those mutations like Chris was talking about, that would tell you that it was cancer or not cancer. But it's very difficult when somebody's telling you, I'm not certain it's thyroid cancer, but I'm also not certain it's benign and you have to do something. The last piece to it is the last piece of that question that says, I'm worried about how I'm going to feel when I take my thyroid out. We used to say, don't worry about that. Take the thyroid out. We've got thyroid hormone pills and you'll feel great. We finally listened to our patients enough to know that that's not always the case, that most of my patients, they feel about 90% of normal. But a lot of folks don't feel 100% normal when they don't have their thyroid. So, you know, I think it is a realistic thing to think about. You just have to work with the individual physician and say, okay, do you think the risk this is cancer is 25 or is it 75? What's my age? What's the risk of doing the surgery? So all of that has to be done as a team approach.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And our next question, Kate?
Our next question comes from the line of Brenda M. Your line is open.
Yes, hi, good afternoon. I was diagnosed with stage 1 papillary thyroid cancer, and I opted not to do the iodine treatment, and I wanted to find out if you've had any cases such as that and if there was a reoccurrence of cancer or the outcome.
Well, Brenda, thank you for that excellent question. I'm going to ask Dr. Miskowitz to address your question, but to address it in a general way, and then we'll advise you to go back to your treating healthcare team to really address your own specific details. But Dr. Miskowitz, could you address that question in a general way?
So obviously the risk of this cancer coming back, even if you're not going to receive the radioactive iodine, it's not going to be high. And at the same time, something that we have to emphasize most of the time when you have the papillary thyroid cancer, this is very indolent disease, which is slow growing. So any kind of active follow-up, I think, should be able to identify if this cancer is going to be back and eventually address, you know, immediately. So obviously, definitely you need some kind of form of surveillance. So obviously, you need a sequence of sonogram because this cancer most of the time comes back locally. And obviously, you're going to be able to identify if this cancer actually really, really return and then can be treated surgically. Most of the time, we kind of like local treatments that involve surgery, but at the same time, obviously, if you're going to have any evidence after the second surgery that this cancer carries any additional high-risk factors, then yes, then obviously I would recommend the radioactive iodine after.
Yeah, I agree, Chris. I mean, I think this is a really important issue. And at Memorial, we have hundreds and hundreds of patients that we've followed for 50 years with no radioactive iodine. it goes away from sort of the traditional everybody gets surgery, everybody gets radioactive iodine, but even in the new guidelines that are going to be published this year, it's going to say not everybody needs radioactive iodine, and in low-risk patients, they will do just absolutely as well. So the caller is in good company. There's lots of folks with low-risk cancer that have not gotten radioactive iodine, and as Chris said, the key is follow-up. Follow-up with the ultrasound and the blood test.
Excellent. And Kate, our next question?
Our next question comes from the line of Nancy D. Your line is open.
Yes, I'd like to know what the qualifications are for a surgeon who does thyroidectomies.
Excellent question. Dr. Tuttle, do you want to address that?
Yeah, depends on if you're asking a surgeon or an endocrinologist. It's always difficult. So what we say is we want an experienced surgeon, and most of the time that's somebody that's doing 10 or 20 thyroid surgeries a year. And in most regions in the country, you can find somebody that's done 10 or 20 thyroid surgeries a year. So it kind of depends on how they trained. It's a critical piece to the puzzle, and as you're finding out, it's really hard to find out if they're good or not good. The people that know is your endocrinologist. The endocrinologist that have helped you make the diagnosis, the primary care doctor that have helped you make the diagnosis, they've seen the surgeons that they're recommending operate on numerous other people. So you'll have a hard time probably finding out the numbers, so you have to rely on the rest of your healthcare team and say, have you used this surgeon before and how great did they do?
Excellent. Thank you. Great question. And also, should we say something about seeing sometimes going for second opinions as well around choosing a physician? Could you address that as well, Dr. Tuttle?
Yeah, absolutely. I work at a big referral center, so I am always a fan of second opinions. I don't think second opinions ever hurt anybody. If you get a second opinion and they tell you the first thing is the first doctor, fine and dandy. So, you know, I think for each individual case, you don't always have to have a second opinion. But if it's anything more than very straightforward, very simple, you have any reservations, concern at all, in thyroid cancer, it's seldom one that you have to operate tomorrow. You've got a month, you've got 6 weeks, in the vast majority of cases, to get second opinion. So I often say, slow down, do your work on the internet, call cancer care, talk to people on FICA. They'll be able to give you a feel whether there's something unusual or are you getting the right advice. So, I'm a huge fan of second opinions when it's appropriate.
And at the same time, obviously, we have to mention that as, you know, patients are receiving second opinion, it doesn't mean that the first physician who made any recommendation, he is wrong, because obviously we can have different opinion, and obviously as patients, they have different approaches and different feeling how the cancer can be treated, and even over the previous question, whether we should or shouldn't give radioactive iodine to patients. So it's more to kind of give you the selection of possibilities, how this cancer can be addressed. So it's not like I would say that one physician is bad and the other one is correct. So it's more about opinion and, you know, selection rather than anything else.
I agree completely, Chris, because especially as this landscape of thyroid cancer is treating and we're trying to figure out who do we start on your drugs, when do we watch, who do we do radioactive iodine, when do we not, you know, we're all going to have our own little opinions on that. And sometimes it's just we explain the same thing using different words. And so going through it a couple times. So I agree. I don't think it's a right or wrong. It's sort of getting as many different opinions, hearing it explained several different ways so you're really comfortable that you have all the information you need to make the right decision.
That's such an important point, that the whole issue of just really taking that information in from different people presenting it to you, people, different doctors telling you something, and finally you're finding a comfort zone of what you're going to do. That's really very important as well. And Sarah, do you want to comment on that? Just because I know in a lot of the groups that we run, people are often struggling with, you know, what to do and how to make a decision and who to go and which doctor to choose.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think that Dr. Tuttle made some excellent points when he was discussing it. And so just to sort of piggyback on a lot of that, it really, you know, for the second opinion, it doesn't hurt, you know, and I think it just gives you more information. You know, you want to gather information. I think that's really the key. You want to find out from different sources what did they do? What do they recommend? What, you know, if they do recommend going in and having a surgery or doing, you know, perhaps a different treatment, what are the side effects? How is this going to affect your quality of life? You know, basically what to expect. That's really what you want to do. And this is something that comes up often, whether, you know, it's someone calling in on the phone, and especially in support groups, you know, often people are coming together to talk about sort of their experience with it. And I think there's a lot to be gained from that. You really do want to gather information. And I can't remember, I don't remember if it was Dr. Tuttle or Dr. Miskiewicz who brought up Psycho, but that's also a great resource. You know, there's a lot of information there too. So you really want to gather information. And, you know, we're here. You can always call us and we can help you with that too.
And at the same time, I want to encourage patients, because obviously I can speak on my behalf as a physician. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that Dr. Tuttle, he feels the same, that we're not going to feel offended. Are we not going to be upset as physician if you're going to go for the second opinion? Because it is about you. It's about you feeling comfortable with this physician. So no matter what your decision subsequently is going to be, if you're going to pick me or any other physician, it's about you. So it always have to be kind of in your focus. So I strongly encourage you that, yes, more information is better than less.
Thank you. Excellent. And our next question, Kate.
Our next question comes from the line of Elaine B. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. I have a question regarding how do you define small nodules? The first doctor talked about the watch and wait in the Japanese study. 3 years ago, they found 1.5 centimeters in mine. Three fine needle biopsies, first atypica cells, but two inconclusive after, and it's decreasing, and this week it remains at 0.9 of a centimeter now. So I'm just wondering how long watch and wait is you can do.
Oh, thank you for that question. Dr. Tuttle, could you address that?
Yeah, so we usually define small nodules as less than a centimeter, which would be about half an inch. So the Japanese studies that have been watching these, and they've been watching them for 10 or 15 years, have generally watched the ones that are less than a centimeter. Not many of them go away. They usually stay about the same size, but occasionally one will gradually go away. But I expect them really kind of to stay the same size. So when we're talking about small things that we're going to watch and not intervene on, we're generally talking about things less than a centimeter.
Dr. Dahl, do you think that the architecture kind of appearance on the sonogram plays in the role and the size?
It certainly does, Chris. So when we look at it, it's not only the size that tells me whether or not it's thyroid cancer, but there's blood flow and there's shape and all those sorts of things on the inside. So the ultrasound can help me let you know if it's half a centimeter. The ultrasound can tell me it's probably cancer, and then you and I would have to decide, do we want to biopsy it? If we do biopsy it, are we going to go to surgery? Do we want to watch? So the ultrasound can give us a lot of information, even without having to do the biopsy.
Thank you. All right, excellent. And we have a question from one of our online participants as well. And actually, it's for Chris. It's actually the question is, what's the controversy regarding the sour candies post-radioactive iodine? I think you mentioned that.
I mean, it's obviously one of the major side effects of treatment with radioactive iodine is basically that people, they can develop this very painful inflammation of the salivary glands, and it can be very, very disturbing. So there are some reports saying that, yes, there is a benefit of having lemon candies used, you know, during the treatment that's going to alleviate those symptoms, but at the same time, there are some reports that it's not. So that I think this is the main area of controversy. So basically, we still don't know if we should or we shouldn't, obviously recommending using those as you're receiving the radioactive iodine.
Okay, thank you. And our next question, Kate?
Our next question comes from the line of Linda B. Your line is open.
Hi. My question has to do with, I've had thyroid cancer, been dealing with it for 22 years. I had three treatments, and my salivary glands got messed up, and my tear ducts got messed up with the third one. So I have some saliva, and I have some drainage of my tear ducts, but it's not optimum. And I think it was, It wasn't Dr. Tuttle. It was the other doctor who mentioned something about clinical trials for dry mouth.
Yes, I mean, obviously, yes, there are many clinical trials, mainly not really in thyroid cancer, because it's not really a very popular form of the treatment of thyroid cancer. It's not really as commonly used as other forms. And most of those studies, they come from head and neck cancer, so it's the same location but a different form of the cancer, when this is kind of the backbone of the treatment. So various treatment modalities were used, including medications like pilocarpine, amifostin, and etc. Most of them, they didn't really show any clear benefit of using them as you receive the chemotherapy and radiation alone. So there is a lot of research. So what I would encourage you, if you are interested, but most of the time those clinical trials are offered as you receiving a radiation, because most of the time those are the protective agents that they're supposed to protect your salivary gland as you're receiving radiation. But at the same time, because it looks like you did receive radiation in the past, you can go to clinicaltrials.gov and just put dryness of the mouth, and you're going to see some of them probably available across the country, and I would encourage you to do so. There are a few drugs that are FDA-approved for xerostomia. The only side effect or contraindication if patient has glaucoma is that you cannot use them. So this is the other option that eventually you can explore and see if it's going to help you. The other modalities is like lozenges, chewing gum, anything that's going to promote the salivary gland production. Then obviously this is something that you can try as well. Some of my patients, they did try acupuncture, but I have to say that some of them, they claim that they see improvement, and some of them, they don't. But this is something that can be tried as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot. And so there is a question about, I'm going to give that question to Dr. Tuttle. Can a patient ever be cancer-free, or are they just in remission? So could you address that, Dr. Tuttle?
That's a great question. We try to dodge that question as much as we can in clinic. In thyroid cancer, to be honest with you, we're never 100% sure somebody's absolutely cured. I'll often say the good news and the bad news about thyroid cancer is it's slow growing. So if we say you're in remission, which means all your blood test markers are zero and the ultrasound looks fine, then the chance of a recurrence is only about 1% or 2%. So that's as close as we ever get to knowing whether somebody's 100% cured, which is why we always say everything was great, you're in remission, and then we finish that with come back and see me again in a year. So we get close to being 100% cured, but we just have to have lifelong follow-up.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. You've just been extraordinary. And I want to thank all of you who've queued up and asked us really great questions, and either online or on telephone. I want to remind you that this is a one-hour program, and that in planning this program, we know that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So I don't want anyone to leave this call thinking that you're alone in coping with thyroid cancer or cancer in general. I want you to know that you're now part of our community of support here at Cancer Care, and you can reach us. Call us anytime at 1-800-813-HOPE. Or you can visit our website at www.cancercare.org. We have a staff of wonderful oncology social workers here to answer your questions and to help you with your concerns. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today and wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may disconnect. Have a wonderful day.